A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 4, Government and Religion.
In this lecture, we'll continue our discussion of Spartan institutions by taking a look at the Spartan governmental apparatus, which was quite distinctive, and Spartan religion, which was less distinctive, but which did have certain characteristic wrinkles of its own, retro. And on the basis of obscurity and the antiquity of the language alone, it seems to come from about as early as the Spartans imagined that it did. Here is a translation, and bear with me, it doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense as you hear it. It'll take a little bit of unpacking. But having established a cult of Selenian Zeus and Athena, having done the tribing and obing, and having established a gerousia of 30 members, including the kings, season in, season out, there to hold a pellae between Babica and Kanakia. The gerousia, and now things get interesting, the gerousia is both to introduce proposals and to stand aloof. The demos is to have the power to give a decisive verdict. But if the demos speaks crookedly, the gerousia and kings are to be removers. Well, several components of the mixed constitution are there. The gerousia, which is mentioned, is the same word as in Latin, senate. It's the old guys. It's the body composed of the old guys. And it composed in Sparta 30 people, all 60 or over. In other words, having successfully completed their full 40-year military commitment, plus the two kings. And about the highest honor that an ordinary Spartan could achieve. And Sparta was a state which even more than most operated on the basis of honor and esteem and the respect which people held for each other. That was what you were supposed to crave. And the way to win that game completely and once and for all was to be elected at age 60 after a long and fruitful military career to the gerousia. Because once you were elected to the gerousia, you served for life. That was also to the extent that Sparta had a supreme court. The gerousia effectively was the supreme court, maybe with the ephors, about which more in a moment, maybe not. Sparta's laws, by the way, were not written down and were designedly not written down, the idea being that where laws should be inscribed is in the hearts and minds of citizens, not on a sheet of paper. What the great rhetor suggests is that the gerousia initiated legislation. Whatever Sparta was to do, the gerousia would formulate and would then bring before the Spartan assembly, which was the group of all Spartan citizens, all of the people who had joined a mess, who'd passed the agoge, basically the Spartan army. Voting, however, was not something that they did by counting or by using pottery shards or anything of that ilk. They voted by acclamation, which is to say they would shout, and under rare circumstances where they wanted to be sure that there was a majority or where they wanted to make people visibly support or stand against a certain proposal, they would physically divide into groups. But ordinarily, voting was just by acclamation, and whoever cheered loudest won the vote. As the great rhetor says, if the kings and the gerousia think the assembly blew it, they have veto power. So that's the normal legislative or quasi-legislative governmental apparatus. the Spartans did have two kings, which is very, very unusual, and had two kings for many centuries, as long as they were an effective independent polity. Both kings claimed descent from Hercules, five or six generations after Hercules, the eponymous kings Agis I and Euripon supposedly gave rise to the Ageids, the senior house, and the Euripontids, the junior house. The first kings that we really know much about were Theopompus, who reigned from somewhere around 1720 into the 600s and was evidently instrumental in conquering Messenia, the great helot land to Sparta's west, and his contemporary Polydorus, who was evidently something of a populist in his leanings. Up until about 500, both Spartan kings would often go into battle together. Then, in a sequence of events which we'll discuss later on when we get to Spartan history, the Spartans changed the ruling on that, and only one king at a time would go out with the army. The king, however, always led the army, and the king also was the only person in Sparta whose death was mourned with an elaborate funeral. Otherwise, in company with the notion of minimizing the impact of death, the least said, Spartan funerals were absolutely minimal, except for kings. And they were so elaborate there that other Greeks thought that they looked almost barbarian. They were just too much. Royal funerals were a very big deal, and the kings got to lead. But they did not, in any unambiguous sense, rule Sparta, though they were very, very influential. Some kings much more so than others. Also, the two royal houses were often in rivalry with each other and often did not get along very well. So there was a kind of a built-in check and balance in the very fact of having two royal houses, which the Spartans evidently valued. More influential in later times, certainly as influential in later times, as either the kings or the Gerousia, or certainly the assembly, were a group who were not mentioned in the Great Rhetra, but who shortly thereafter, and maybe then, and they just weren't important, were a part of the Spartan system. And they are the Ephors, E-P-H-O-R, of whom five were elected each year, for a year, and you are allowed to serve only once in your lifetime. And as you read through Spartan history, the Ephors seem, they were in effect the active executive power. They could and did depose kings, even though they were only in power for a year. It's misleading. In a recent film on Spartan topics, the Ephors are shown as very, very old. That would be more appropriate to the Gerousia. The Ephors, in fact, could be elected from anyone who is a full citizen, which is to say basically anyone 30 or over, and people did serve as Ephors, in fact, quite young. But they were the real executive power in Sparta. Two other aspects, the perioeci, the helots, and the vast array of sub-citizens we've already mentioned, they had no constituted political power whatsoever, and neither did Spartan women. But here the situation is a little less clear. In fact, though not officially, the evidence suggests that Spartan women had a lot of power. Stephen Pressfield, in his Gates of Fire, indeed, and the greatest authority in the scholarly world, currently active On the subject of Sparta, Paul Cartledge of Cambridge suggests this is plausible, though there's no evidence, I mean, but it's true in some sense, to the spirit of Sparta. Pressfield claims that the folks who were detached on the suicide mission to Thermopylae were, among other things, those whose women could take it. And what's historically plausible about that is that that would have been a concern at Sparta, where the women were very, very important, unusually so, for sure, in the ancient world. For the most part, Spartan religion was the same as the religion of the rest of the Hellenic world. They worshipped the Olynian gods, they practiced various forms of omen-taking, they participated in They offered animal sacrifices. In fact, taking the auspices very often, indeed characteristically, involved animal sacrifice. None of those things is distinctive to Sparta. What was distinctive to Sparta, according to authorities at the time, to contemporaries, was they took the gods very, very, very seriously. They were in some respect, the most scrupulous of all the Greeks, or certainly right up there, in comparison with the Athenians, strikingly so. But that's not to say that Spartan religion didn't have some distinctive features. One, which is to me kind of appealing, is they did worship Menelaus and Helen, who were, according to Homer, of course, the king and queen of Sparta. And indeed, there was a sanctuary to Helen and Menelaus built at Therapne, called the Menelaon, very near where the Mycenaean Spartan settlement had been. On the other side of the Eurotas River, on the east side rather than the west side, and headed up again into the foothills of Mount Parnon, a very, very striking sight. Also, nearby at Amyclae, again a sort of Trojan connection, that there was a shrine to Alexandra, who seems to have been Cassandra, the Trojan princess, who is prominent in not only the Iliad, but also in Aeschylus's Agamemnon. What's going on with Helen is not entirely clear. I mean, she is, although a morally complex character, to put the matter relatively gently, she also seems to be connected in some sense clearly to Aphrodite, but beyond that even to Astarte, who is a Near Eastern fertility goddess, and finally in some odd sense to the Great Mother herself. In any case, worship of Helen goes back a long way. There is an interesting story told about the wife of one of the later Spartan kings, who was, as a child, so we are informed, so breathtakingly ugly that her parents couldn't stand to look at her. And her helot maid took her to the shrine of Helen and prayed that Helen would give her beauty. And a lovely female figure miraculously appeared, and presumably Helen, and sure enough, this hideously ugly girl grew up to be a Spartan queen and also the most beautiful woman in Sparta. So, in some sense, they took this pretty seriously. So, too, and many throughout Greece did, but because these folks were Spartan, the Spartans most of all, Pollux and Castor, the Tyndaridae, the sons of Tyndareus, Helen's putative father, though her real father was Zeus, so these guys are at least her half-brothers, the divine boys, which is what Dies Curi means, the sign of Gemini, is a stellification, so to speak, of these divine twin boys, Pollux and Castor. And the Spartans claimed that at times they, as heroes, long after their death, had inspired or even in some sense fought with them. It's an interesting thing. The literary remains of Greek religion don't quite prepare you for what you see if you look at the archaeological remains. The Dioscorae don't figure very largely, that is to say, in existing Greek myth, but there are lots of statues devoted to them, not just in Sparta, but all over Greece. They seem, for whatever reason, to have loomed larger in actual imagination and practice. The story goes that one was divine and one wasn't, or one was immortal and one wasn't, and they were so close as twins that when the time came for the mortal one to die, they begged that they might share in immortality, and so they were alive on alternate days, which presumably made companionship difficult, but allowed them nonetheless to share the wealth of divinity in some sense. Most distinctive, though, what most set Spartan religion apart from religion elsewhere in at least most of Greece was a cycle of three festivals, which to the Spartans were tremendously important, so much so that they delayed attending very, very important battles on which, so it would seem, the very existence of Sparta depended, to avoid offending the gods by not participating fully in these festivals. And they were, as they cycled through the summer months, the Hyacinthia, the Gymnopaedia, and finally the Carnea, which was more or less a pan-Doric festival. All Doric groups and cities evidently celebrated the Carnea. This is a little surprising that these festivals loom so very, very large, because the patron deities of Sparta, at least purportedly, were Zeus and Athena, Polyukos, the guardian of the city, or Athena Kalkiokos, Athena of the Bronze House, which was the name of her major temple in Sparta. It's kind of odd to think of Athens and Sparta both being under the patronage of Athena. But in fact, all of these festivals were devoted primarily to Apollo, who seems in some sense to have been a god especially beloved by the Dorians. And so too, though to a lesser extent, his sister Artemis, the goddess of the hunt. The fullest treatment of these cults that I know of was written by a man named Michael Pettersson, published in Stockholm, 1992, which bears the informative title Cults of Apollo at Sparta, the Hyacinthia, Gymnopaedia, and the Carnea. And he looks at them as a series of rituals which encode the process of initiation by which predominantly boys, but women too, were incorporated into the citizen body. Whether that is in fact really the way the Spartans thought of it, I am not in a position to say, but we can say some things about it. The Hyacinthia came first, relatively early in summer. It commemorated originally Hyacinthos, who in some sense is amalgamated with Apollo and is connected particularly with the village of Amyclae, which was part of Sparta, but somewhat outside of Sparta, and they would have processions to Amyclae, which were part of the festival. The myth having to do, or a myth having to do with Apollo and Hyacinthos, was that Hyacinthos was a beautiful young boy whom Apollo loved, whom he inadvertently killed with an errant discus throw. And so in that sense, it's kind of sad. And then a hyacinth grows up to sort of commemorate him. There seems to have been another story about somebody named Hyacinthos II, who was a grown man rather than a youth, who for some reason had to sacrifice his daughter Polyboia in a configuration that seems to recall, in some sense, Agamemnon sacrificing Iphigenia. And there are surviving images which suggest that, in some sense, both of these irreconcilable myths were in place somehow in the Hyacinthia. It started off, evidently, as a festival of mourning for the death of Hyacinthos, but then they had some kind of celebratory meal when it modulated into a celebration of the enduring life of Hyacinthos or some such, and a meal in which, unusually, not just citizens, but perioeci and even helots could participate. So there's some kind of communal, regeneration or some kind of uncharacteristic, by and large, celebration of unity in the polis, which seems to be going on in the Hyacinthia as well. There's also a suggestion that, as well as being part and parcel of an initiation cycle for boys, it was also a sort of initiation of women or young girls into marriage, the idea being that as Hyacinthos had to sacrifice Polyboia, his daughter, so young girls who were on the verge of being married sacrificed their virginity, something like that. But again, it's difficult to be any more specific than that. Be that as it may, it was clearly very, very important to the Spartans, and so was the Gymnopaedia, which was held later on in the summer, evidently close to high summer when the heat was at its maximum. This one, outsiders often attended in part to listen to the choruses, which had practiced and which sang more or less competitively, the youths, the grown men, and the old men. The youths singing basically, "Boy, I sure hope that we get to be as good as the guys who are soldiers now, and I'll bet we will. We really want to." The soldiers singing, "Boy, we're great soldiers right now." And the old guy singing, "Yeah, but, you know, man, so are we too." Something like that. It's a celebration by various age groups of the Spartan martial ethos. It means either the festival of the naked boys or the festival of the unarmed boys, naked in that sense, whichever was the thrust of the meaning. Gymnos or gymnos ordinarily means naked, simply. It involved for young boys a kind of endurance contest of dancing in the hot sun for a long, long, long time. And those who held out under those trying conditions for the longest gained honor accordingly. The Carnea seems to have been a Pandoric festival, and Pedersen sees this as the moment of integration when people, in effect, graduated from the agoge into full adulthood, and he also is under the impression that this was when 12-year-old boys and their lovers-to-be first made contact. It also involved a kind of symbolic race in which somebody, a man with woolen fillets, whatever exactly those are, coiled around his body, ran, and lots of young folks tried to catch him, and presumably generally did, the idea being that if they succeeded in catching him, it would bring about good luck for the rest of the year. Spartans, whatever was in fact going on at these festivals, made a very big point of attending them at considerable cost, if at all possible. They loomed very large in Spartan communal life. There's one other festival of a sort which really struck outsiders, especially in later times. There was evidently, from early on the banks of the Eurotas, a shrine to a local goddess, Orthia, who is later assimilated to Artemis, so it becomes a shrine of Artemis Orthia. A temple was built there in the 700s, a refurbished and improved temple in the 570s. Orthia itself goes back to, as far as can be told, prehistoric times. And in classical Sparta, there was a festival in which adolescents, people who were in the midst of the agoge, not the really young ones and not people who were about to graduate, but somewhere in between, would attempt to steal cheeses from the altar of Artemis Orthia, and other boys around them would whip them to try to keep them from succeeding in getting those cheeses. And the point seems to have been some kind of endurance contest in which the stock in trade is pain tolerance, and the boy who demonstrated the most energy and pain tolerance won, which again, in a military context, unpleasant as it may be, makes a certain amount of sense. Later on, in Roman times, when Sparta had become something not unlike a historical theme park, the festival in honor of Artemis Orthia featured something which they called the diamastagosis, where boys were whipped for as long as they could take without begging off. And the winner sometimes was whipped to death. And this was a sort of sado-tourism thrill site which tourists came to enjoy throughout Roman times. Now, how we get from stealing cheeses and the whipping going on there to the diamastagosis is unclear, and exactly what the theory was is also unclear. Nevertheless, you can still go see the remains of the temple. There were lots and lots of votive offerings, little figurines and whatnot, deposited at the temple, and something that they don't write about much in the literature but is prominent in the Sparta Museum is there were also associated with Artemis Orthia clay masks, which are really grotesque. They remind me a bit of Iroquois false faces, which were designed to be as grotesque and frightening as possible, and they played some part, evidently, in these proceedings. You know, I could imagine what they might be, but there's no real evidence as what they might be. But nevertheless, they've excavated a lot of these masks around the site of it. So that evidently was part of the package as well.
This ends Lecture 4. Remember to visit this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures you just heard. Once there, you can access this course by using the password 1134TBS. Again, that's 1134TBS.